Welcome to the Skeptic's Guide to Emergency Medicine. Meet 'em, greet 'em, treat 'em, and street 'em. Today's date is March 26th, 2015, and I am your skeptical host, Ken Milne. The title of today's podcast is Early Goal-Directed Therapy. Promises, promises. And we have guest skeptics. Yes, skeptics, with an S. There's two. We have Dr. Sunil Upadhyay and Dr. Tiffany Osborne. Sunil is an associate clinical professor of emergency medicine at McMaster University and an associate member of clinical epidemiology and biostatistics. He also is the chair of the CAPES Standards Committee and a sepsis enthusiast. Welcome back to the SGEM, Sunil.
Thanks, Ken. Glad to be back.
And we are very excited. It should be. It's in my voice, right? We are very excited to have Dr. Tiffany Osborne, the second author on the PROMISE trial. Tiffany is an associate professor in the Department of Surgery and Department of Emergency Medicine at Washington University in St. Louis. Welcome to the SGEM, Tiffany.
Thank you for having me.
Now, Tiffany, you're a surgeon and an emergency physician?
No. I'm an emergency physician and a surgical trauma intensivist. So half my time is in the emergency department and half my time is in the surgical trauma intensive care unit. I just have a joint appointment with both departments.
I understand. Well, it's been a big year in sepsis management with not one, but two major trials already being published.
That's right, Ken. It was a big year in sepsis research. First, there was the PROCESS trial, which was the three-armed randomized control trial published last spring in the New England Journal of Medicine comparing different outcomes in sepsis resuscitation and found no difference in full-fledged early goal-directed therapy versus semi-structured, protocolized usual care, and then the final usual care, quote-unquote, in reducing 60-day in-hospital mortality and various pre-specified secondary outcomes.
The SGEM bottom line from episode number 69, Cry Me a River, was effective care for septic shock hinges on early recognition, lactate screening, intravenous crystalloid resuscitation, and early broad-spectrum antibiotics.
And there was also the ARISE trial, Ken. Remember that ARISE was the two-arm randomized control trial that was published in the fall in New England Journal of Medicine. And it was comparing early goal-directed therapy versus usual care in reducing the 90-day all-cause mortality and a number of pre-specified secondary outcomes.
And the SGEM bottom line from episode number 92, arise up, was invasive early goal-directed therapy-based sepsis resuscitation is not required compared to early recognition and liberal IV fluid resuscitation and empiric antibiotics in the septic patients. So let's use the same case we used last time, Sunil, to discuss sepsis management.
Okay, Ken. So here's the case again. You see a 62-year-old male sent from a nursing home with a 3-day history of a productive cough, intermittent fevers, and today he's a bit confused. The transfer notes include a history of the usual Cs, CHF, COPD, coronary artery disease, gout, hypertension, type 2 diabetes, and reports mild dementia. On arrival in the emergency department, his vitals are as follows. His temperature is 39.1 degrees Celsius. His heart rate is 103 beats per minute. The blood pressure is 115 over 100. The respiratory rate is 26. His oxygen saturation on room air is 92%. And his capillary blood sugar is measured as normal.
So what's the question we're going to try to answer on today's episode of the SGEM, Tiffany?
Does an emergency department patient with septic shock or severe sepsis need aggressive early goal-directed therapy, or is usual resuscitation sufficient?
So, Sunil, we've covered this background material for sepsis in a number of other podcasts. However, I think it is important to review some of the definitions and recognize that sepsis is a continuum.
That's correct. You can never hear this enough, Ken. So the definition of sepsis can be defined as a clinical syndrome complicating severe infection characterized by the SIRS criteria, inflammation remote to the site of infection, and subsequent dysregulation of inflammatory responses leading to multisystem organ dysfunction.
So that systemic inflammatory response syndrome, or SIRS criteria, include a temperature of over 38 degrees Celsius or less than 36 degrees Celsius, a heart rate over 90 beats per minute, a respiratory rate over 20 breaths per minute, or PCO2 less than 32, and a white blood cell count less than 4,000 or over 12,000 or greater than 10% immature forms.
That's correct, Ken, and it's important for listeners to know that lots of things can cause the Sears syndrome. However, sepsis is when you have 2 to 4 of the Sears criteria and a presumed source of infection as the cause of Sears.
And if you move down that continuum, Sunil, severe sepsis is sepsis plus hypotension and end organ failure, such as hypoxia, renal failure, hepatic failure, coagulopathies, hypotension, and a lactate level greater than 2.
And the end stage of severe sepsis then, Ken, as mentioned, is septic shock, which is the previous definition, severe sepsis, and hypotension that's refractory to fluid management after fluid boluses, or a lactate greater than 4 millimolar.
Well, it is my great pleasure to have Tiffany, one of the lead authors on the PROMISE trial, introduce and give the title of her recent New England Journal article.
So the title of the article is Trial of Early Goal-Directed Resuscitation for Septic Shock. And this was really, I mean, it wasn't just my article, clearly. I mean, it was a team. It really takes a village to do this. I mean, our chief investigator, Kathy Rowan, is amazing. And, you know, our trial manager, Paul Mouncey, trial statisticians, and Sarah and David. And there are many, many more people who are involved in this, research teams at over 56 sites. It takes a lot of coordinated effort to get this done.
Well, we like to go through a PICO to start the critical appraisal, and that's the population intervention control and outcome. So, Sunil, what was the population that they were looking at in this PROMISE trial?
The population here was similar to previous, which are adult patients presenting to the emergency department with early septic shock, defined as 2+ SIRS criteria, with refractory hypotension, systolic blood pressure less than 90 millimeters of mercury, despite fluid resuscitation of at least 1 liter of crystalloid within 60 minutes of arrival in the ED, or also including the definition was hyperlactate elevation of greater than 4 millimolar. And these are patients that were recruited from 56 hospitals in the United Kingdom, 29% of which were teaching hospitals. So this is essentially the quarter of the hospitals in the United Kingdom participating in this trial.
Wow, that's a big trial. Now, there was a number of exclusions, and I'm not going to list them here, but I will list them in the blog note. How about the intervention?
So the intervention arm was early goal-directed therapy as written in the original 2001 article by Rivers et al. The other thing is that all patients in both arms did receive antibiotics appropriately before randomization to either arm.
And what was this control of usual care?
The quote-unquote usual care group was discretionary care by the treating physicians, including monitoring, various investigations, and treatments as per their clinical expertise and clinical appropriateness.
And what outcomes were they looking at, Sunil?
The primary outcome of interest was 90-day all-cause mortality. The secondary outcomes were SOFA scores measured at 6 and 72 hours, the need for organ support, cardiovascular, respiratory, and renal dialysis, in critical care environments up to 28 days, length of stay in the ED, the ICU, and the hospital, all-cause mortality at 28 days during the entire hospitalization, whatever duration that was, and at 1 year, survival duration, and most interestingly, they collected data on health-related quality of life as measured on a validated 5-point scale, as well as resource usage and costs of care at 90 days and 1 year.
Sunil, you mentioned a SOFA score. I assume you're not talking about couches here?
Not at all. I'll have to defer this one to Tiffany. She's the critical care expert here.
So the SOFA score is basically a sequential organ function assessment score, and it gives you a way of looking at illness severity.
Perfect. So Tiffany, what were your conclusions to this paper?
In patients with severe sepsis who are identified early and received intravenous antibiotics and adequate fluid resuscitation, hemodynamic management according to a strict early goal-directed therapy protocol did not lead to an improvement in outcome.
I just love having the author read their own conclusions. All right, Sunil, let's go through the quality checklist for randomized clinical control trials. Number one, the study population included or focused on those in the emergency department?
Fortunately, yes, these are papers directly relevant to emergency physicians.
Did they randomize them adequately?
Yes, they did, using permuted block randomization.
Now, did the randomization process, was it concealed?
The process isn't concealed. The allocation can't be, for reasons we'll talk about in a second.
Now, were the patients analyzed in the groups which they were randomized?
Yes, an intention to treat protocol was specified for analysis.
And did they recruit patients consecutively?
Yes, it seems that they did.
And were both groups similar with respect to prognostic factors?
Yes, there's a table in the paper that suggests they were essentially equal.
And all participants, were they unaware of their group allocation?
No, because these would be difficult trials to blind, because it's obvious to the clinicians and the patients which arm you've been randomized to if you get a bunch of lines stuck into you as opposed to not.
Sure. Now, were all groups treated equally except for the intervention?
Yes, there were equal co-interventions in both groups.
How was the follow-up? Was it greater than 80%?
It was spectacular. It was over 98%.
Were all patient important factors considered?
Certainly seems to be the case.
And the final question number 11, was the treatment effect large enough and precise enough to be clinically significant?
There was no difference in the treatment effect, so that question really doesn't matter, although precision was tight.
Okay, so let's go through the results then.
So methodologically, this is a parallel arm superiority trial with one-to-one randomization in permuted blocks of 4 patients, 6 patients, or 8 blocks at a time. 1,260 patients were needed for the sample size, and 1,243 completed the trial, which is greater than 98% follow-up for the primary outcome of interest, which is wonderful from a loss to follow-up point of view.
And you mentioned earlier that the baseline characteristics were well-matched in both arms, including infectious sources.
That's true. There are tables in the subsequent appendices and the protocols you can get online that shows that. They were unable to blind physicians to the intervention allocations for obvious reasons, because you know if you're putting in lines or the patient's receiving lines versus not. It is important to understand, though, that even though physicians and patients by definition could not be blinded, the outcome assessors were blinded externally once they received the data sets.
All right, I think that's an important point. However, only 1/3 of patients screened were successfully recruited, with poor recruitment on weekends and nights, Tiffany.
Right. Well, recruitment rate of eligible patients in our trial was very similar to the other two trials, and we report it in pretty specific detail in the supplemental. We did have lower recruitments on weekends and at night, and really what that indicates is the challenges associated with conducting emergency and critical care research. I mean, the ED is operational 24/7, and research infrastructure generally is not. But that is an important component, because as we continue to try to do these emergency research trials or resuscitation trials, they need to be resourced differently than other types of trials that are dealing with people who are coming into clinic.
All right. Well, since we're talking economics, they did some economic evaluation, Sunil.
Yeah, this was really exciting, Ken. I was thrilled to see this. So the economic evaluation done in this pragmatic RCT was based on resources costed on values of 2012 British pounds and then converted to US dollars. Cost effectiveness was determined using threshold willingness to pay for quality adjusted or so-called QALY gains as per the National Institute for Clinical Effectiveness guidelines in the United Kingdom, which are benchmarked at 20,000 British pounds per QALY, and that converts to US dollars, $28,430 per QALY gained.
Now, some of the results included whether the patients adhered to the protocol. I'm not going to go through all the details on that one either. I'll throw a table in the blog. But what we really want to get to is that primary outcome, Tiffany. What was the primary outcome from the PROMISE trial?
So there was no statistically significant difference in the primary outcomes of the study.
So does that mean that for the primary outcome, there was no superiority of early goal-directed therapy compared to usual care?
So Ken, that's exactly right. The 90-day mortality of early goal-directed therapy was 29.5%. And for usual care, it was 29.2%. That gives us a relative risk in the early goal-directed therapy group around 1.01 with a 95% confidence interval between 0.85 to 1.20.
Wow, no superiority. How about the secondary outcomes?
So secondary outcomes, mortality at 28 days, there was no difference. It was about 25% in each group. Mortality at hospital discharge, no difference, 25.6 versus 24.6.
How about median length of stay, Sunil?
Well, these are metrics that are important to every administrator in the department. So in the emergency department, the length of stay was essentially meaningless, difference-wise, of about 12 minutes. In the ICU, however, the length of stay was 2.6 days in early goal-directed therapy patients versus 2.2 days in the usual care patients. And I don't know the significance of that, but I think Tiffany can speak to that in a bit. With regards to overall hospital length of stay, however, there was absolutely no difference, 9 days in both arms.
Are there any other secondary outcomes you want to mention, Tiffany?
SOFA scores were slightly higher in the early goal-directed therapy group, actually, and it was significant. It was between 5.6 to 6.4, so about a half a point different, but it was statistically significant. And there was more cardiovascular organ support, as well as Sunil pointed out, about a half-day increase in the median ICU length of stay.
What about quality of life, Sunil?
This is really important, Ken, and the health-related quality of life measurements showed that there was no difference in either arm, and economically matching that with quality of life, the quality-adjusted life year cost differences up to 90 days also showed no difference.
Sunil, I think you bring up a really important point here that should be emphasized. The quality of life for this patient population was significantly lower than for age and gender-matched control population. So what we're saying here is that when people leave the hospital, they're actually doing worse than age and gender matched people in the general population. This is a component that is very important. How to improve quality of life after the patient leaves the hospital. There's not a lot of research on it, and it's a very important component of what we can do for our patients.
Tiffany, your team also did something very important and interesting. You looked at cost. Was it more expensive to do early goal-directed therapy versus usual care?
It was. The average cost up to 90 days was about $1,500 higher in the early goal-directed therapy group, partly because of the higher cost of delivering the intervention, but mainly it was because of the increased average ICU length of stay.
Now, we've talked about the lack of benefit from early goal-directed therapy. What about the harm, Sunil?
That's really important. When you're showing two trial interventions that don't necessarily have a difference in benefit, you want to be sure at least that one doesn't cause more harm than the other. And in this trial, head-to-head, there was no difference in the serious adverse event rates, about 4.8 versus 4.2%, which is clinically meaningless.
All right, so we've talked about the key results. Sunil, let's go through some of the commentary.
Ken, this is the last of the trifecta, or the holy trinity, of early goal-directed therapy sepsis articles in the last year, and conceivably is in fact the final nail in the coffin for early goal-directed therapy for adult septic shock patients in the emergency department.
So, Sunil, I would actually say maybe a nail with caveats. From a population standpoint, in institutions where usual care entails a system of consistent early identification. Remember that these patients were identified within about an hour and a half of presentation to the emergency department. Early IV fluids, and again, remember, 2 liters prior to being randomized, and early antibiotics, because part of the protocol was that these patients had to have antibiotics initiated before they could be randomized into the study. And early lactate measurement. So when your usual care is similar to what was done in this study, as well as the other three, we were all similar, you can expect similar outcomes such as promised. If you're not doing that, you are not going to have similar outcomes. Additionally, we need to further explore what usual care actually was in our study. We need to look at if there are any subpopulations that could potentially benefit, and we're not sure yet.
Okay, well, the results mirror the earlier results from the PROCESS, which is the U.S. trial, the ARISE trial, which was mainly in Australia and New Zealand, comparing early goal-directed therapy versus usual care protocols, and showing no difference between any of the arms worldwide. Again, Trial planners agreed to harmonize the endpoints of all three trials so future meta-analyses could confirm these results using individual patient data.
Yeah, so trial-level meta-analysis has already been conducted, Ken.
Ooh, yeah. I like it.
And is submitted for publication. So as you indicate, having harmonized the three trials, we plan an individual patient-level data meta-analysis to explore other important subgroups.
If I can interject here, Tiffany, I think this level of harmonization is an innovative and really commendable collaboration across the world. It's kind of unprecedented, really, to further the goals of individual patient meta-analysis and subgroup exploration that really hasn't been seen before at the global level. So I would commend all the author groups on this.
We are very fortunate because the PIs and the senior statisticians, they were in communication and they're very innovative and they're very forward thinking. And I have been very fortunate to work with, you know, ICNARC and their group. I mean, that it is a very, very strong group. The other piece beyond this being like a global collaboration is that it's one of the few in critical care that involves the full spectrum where patients come in through the emergency department and then follows them either to the ward or to the ICU. And I really, one of the things that I liked about this was the collaboration between the different services, emergency medicine, hospitalist service, ICU. The whole collaboration, I thought, was innovative.
Well, before we start critically appraising your future meta-analysis, Sunil, let's continue along with the critical appraisal of the PROMISE trial.
Sure. The failure to reproduce the original 2001 Rivers early goal-directed therapy results in these three most recent trials probably reflects a worldwide increase in attention to recognizing acutely ill septic patients and shock patients and aggressively treating them, albeit in a non-invasive manner, that most ER physicians now are using as the standard of care. It's pretty clear now that expensive and invasive care for these patients is not universally necessary.
I'm really glad that you brought that up. First, I think it's important not to lose sight of the importance of the Rivers trial. I mean, his concept of early identification and treatment, the idea that sepsis is a time-sensitive disease, was revolutionary for its time. Just that idea alone has been an important contributor to how care has changed. I mean, given the attention focused on sepsis, it is highly likely that usual resuscitation has improved over the last 10 to 15 years since the study by Rivers and colleagues. An important consideration, however, when interpreting the results of PROMISE and those from the other trials, this whole harmonized trilogy, including PROCESS and ARISE, is that the patients recruited to PROMISE were identified early and received early IV fluids, early antimicrobial drugs prior to randomization. Then, in this group of patients, subsequent algorithm-driven early goal-directed therapy, as defined by the six-hour resuscitation protocol from the RIVER study and colleagues, including continuous central venous oxygen saturation monitoring, did not lead to an improvement in outcomes and increased costs of care.
I'll agree with your comment about the RIVERS trial, Tiffany, briefly. Very few eMERGE docs get to claim that they changed the world and changed the course of medical history. And Emmanuel Rivers gets to make that claim in 2001, even though his protocol has now been revised and refined. Of note, this trial did calculate utility measures using health-related quality of life using validated tools and did find that early goal-directed therapy was more expensive than usual care, although not significantly so, and the incremental net benefit of early goal-directed therapy over usual care was negligible, aside from the ICU half-day costs that, Tiffany, you've already talked about. It is rare to have simultaneous real-time economic evaluations done in large randomized control trials, so when they are done, and when they're done properly, as it was done here, the results are even more informative.
I appreciate that, and I'm sure Richard Grieve, who is our lead for the integrated economic evaluation, his heart is probably beating very happily right now to hear you say that. In our opinion, cost-effectiveness analysis should be an integral component of every trial, and we should start including them in our grant applications in the United States. And I would just put forward to you that by designing the economic evaluation upfront, we were able to undertake a rigorous analysis, and this was very helpful in informing clinical decision making and the additional resources that were required to deliver early goal-directed therapy. If you think about it, in a lot of the early goal-directed therapy analyses, they were retrospective. So it's an important consideration because they were guessing what was used and how much was used. Here we could actually truly identify in a prospective manner exactly what was used so we could provide the best information possible.
That's a crucial point, Tiffany, in that prospective real-time costing of interventions is far more robust than retrospective decision tree analyses. If you read the work of Drummond Rennie and what have you, they'll tell you you should always collect this data prospectively so you have the truth and you're not just guessing.
I'm sure that my colleague, Richard, is toasting in your honor right now with a glass of wine.
There have been some other great foamy reviews on the PROMISE trial. Salim Razai from Rebel EM, Richard Boddy at St. Emlyn's blog, Ryan Radicki of EM Lit of Note, and of course, The Bottom Line. But speaking of which, let's compare our conclusions to the author's conclusions, Sunil.
Yeah, our BEAM group looked at this trial with excitation, and we agreed with Tiffany's conclusion from earlier on. However, as in previous trials, it's important to emphasize this does not refute any protocolized care. However, just aggressive, invasive, perhaps expensive early goal-directed therapy in its original 2001 version. Every study group and even the Surviving Sepsis Campaign guidelines still recommend the use of sepsis protocols that emphasize 1. Early recognition of septic patients, 2. Copious IV crystalloid resuscitation, 3. Ongoing lactate screening at least at 0 and 6 hours, and finally 4. Targeted or at least broad-spectrum antibiotic system as possible.
So the Skeptic's Guide to Emergency Medicine bottom line is there is no need to provide invasive, expensive early goal-directed therapy in emergency departments for septic shock patients. Sunil, can you bring us back to that case that we started with and give us a case resolution?
Sure. With the 62-year-old man who came to the emergency department with SIRS criteria and likely sepsis, having recognized this potential and confirming it with a high lactate, you initiate broad-spectrum antibiotics for what is most likely a clinical pneumonia. You give aggressive fluid resuscitation with normal saline or Ringer's lactate. Then you call your consultant and arrange to admit this patient to the ICU.
And so, Tiffany, how can we apply this clinically?
So let's say it's 2 o'clock in the morning and you're working in a single coverage ED. You can start with IV fluids, antibiotics, and lactate measurement. Now, if you have volume refractory shock requiring vasopressors, then most guidelines support administrating them through a central line. Given about half the usual care group receive central lines within about 2 hours after being randomized, indicates that emergency medicine providers are both decisive and capable when they feel central lines are needed.
So, Sunil, what are you going to tell patients?
I'm going to tell the patients, you have a serious infection. Luckily, we've caught it early, and we're going to get lots of fluids, start broad-spectrum antibiotics to do our best to cure you, measure markers to make sure you don't get any sicker, and to see how you're responding to treatment, and you get to stay in the hospital.
Well, that sound indicates it's time for the Keener contest. Last week's winner was Dr. Chris Wood. He knew the Canadian version of PCARN is called PERC, the Pediatric Emergency Research Canada. This week's Keener question is, before there was this thing called the germ theory of disease, it was felt that disease and illness was caused by an imbalance of one of the four humors. One of the common practices at the time was to bloodlet people with fever. We now know that we should be adding fluids and sometimes even blood, not removing it from our septic patients. The first trial to demonstrate this was done by a Scottish military surgeon during the Peninsular War in Portugal 200 years ago. This doctor was skeptical about bloodletting. He took soldiers suffering from camp fever and allocated them randomly into bloodletting or no bloodletting. The trial was set up to remove bias. If someone died of bloodletting, the rationalization could always be, well, clearly we didn't bleed them enough or early enough. All of the biases should have favored the community standard of bloodletting. The results of a 2x2 table demonstrated that 19% of soldiers who were bloodlet died compared to only 3% who were not bloodlet. This gave an NNT of 6 to save one life by not bloodletting. This was the first trial to demonstrate allocation bias or randomization. His paper was called The Inaugural Medical Dissertation on Camp Fever. So, the keener question is, what is the name of this military surgeon from Scotland? If you know the answer, then send me an email, thesgem@gmail.com, with keener in the subject line. The first person to correctly answer the question will receive a cool skeptical prize. Now, Sunil, we have a big conference coming up in Hamilton. Tell me more.
Thanks, Ken. On the heels of our successful Ski Beam conference back in January in British Columbia, we'll be running the Steel Beam conference in Hamilton, Ontario, on April 20th and 21st.
Oh, yes. Time to go back to the hammer and get best evidence in emergency medicine. Well, thanks, Sunil, as the Beam Team sepsis expert, for helping us critically review this paper.
It's my pleasure. I was looking forward to this final chapter of the sepsis trilogy, as it were, and we're looking forward to these new meta-analyses that are coming that Tiffany has already talked about, especially the individual patient data on unique subgroups.
Well, just to be clear, not only has she talked about it, but she's agreed to come back on the SGEM. Thank you, Tiffany, for coming on this time, though, and discussing the PROMISE trial.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Tiffany, as our guest skeptic, you get to give the Skeptic's Guide to Emergency Medicine tagline.
Remember to be skeptical of anything you learn, even if you heard it on the Skeptic's Guide to Emergency Medicine.
Talk to you next week.